Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington.
And I'm Ayan Bior, also in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Thursday, January 14th, 2016. Women in South Sudan demand more positions of power in government.
Many of our sisters, maybe among that, they are the leader also can be in this ministerial, they are at the IDP seeking protection. The government must take its lead to protect the civilian and especially the vulnerable people that are children and women in South Sudan.
And a new report by the Roman Catholic Church says hundreds of homes were burned and young girls raped in Yambio recently. And the church is asking the government to provide psychological counseling.
We make some recommendation to the humanitarian response to help to rescue these situations because the IDPs are really in desperate, in need of food. 9-foot items. There is a need for trauma healing and counseling.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus.
An alliance of South Sudanese women's groups is urging the parties that signed the peace agreement in August to appoint a female speaker for the National Legislative Assembly. They also want women appointed to other high-ranking positions to help balance the power in a society they say is dominated by men. They sent a petition to President Salva Kiir, which was forwarded to the opposition groups, outlining their requests. Philip Thon Oleu reports for VOA from Juba.
Raita Nopidia, Director of AFE Organization for Women Development, praised both parties for distributing the portfolios of ministers earlier this week. Now, she says, it is time to address which women will be appointed to top government positions during the 30 months of transitional government of national unity.
We have seen the executive and all the positions are filled by men. We have seen the president and the vice president and the first vice president are all men. So we are strongly calling that the position of the speaker should be filled by a woman. It is important that there is a balance in the executive. So we strongly urge the president that this time round, the appointment of the speaker for the Transitional National Legislative Assembly should be a woman.
Chapter 1, Article 4, Subsection 11 of the Peace Agreement states that the government shall fill the position of a speaker with someone who hails from the Equatorial region. Nopidia says South Sudan's transitional constitution of 2011 and the August peace agreement requests that 25% of all government positions be occupied by women, a point that should not be up for discussion.
But this time we are saying women are also tired of all the time calling for this 25% women representation. This is constitutional and there is no need for women to beg or ask for the appointment of women in these positions.
Lopidia says a woman speaker of parliament will ensure that legislation is passed to protect the rights of girls to remain in schools and to mount abuses against women in their home. Women rights activist Angelina Daniels-Seka says besides demanding positions of power in the transitional government, women are also demanding protection from the government.
And while we are talking now, many of our sisters, maybe among that, they are the leader also can be in this ministerial, they are at the IDP seeking protection. The government must take its lead to protect the civilian and especially the vulnerable people that are children and women in South Sudan. We can see that how we are suffering now. We need to get back to our normal life that I can get £1 as we can get something for me from the market.
Seka says prices of basic commodities have increased so much that today one South Sudanese pound cannot even buy a sweet or a small piece of candy for a child in Juba. She says if the peace agreement is fully implemented, the value of the South Sudanese pound may stabilize, leading to a lower cost of living. Seka says, in all previous wars in South Sudan, the warring parties agreed to power-sharing governments, but none of the suspected perpetrators of human rights abuses were ever brought to justice. She says, the transitional government of national unity should hold accountable all those who committed atrocities during the conflict.
It is not only for women, but all innocent people who lost their life in South Sudan. We want to see serious accountability. And this one cannot happen unless the international community raise funds and support the peace agreement implementation.
The peace agreement, mediated by the regional bloc IGAD, with support from its international partners, including the United States, proposed that a committee for truth-telling, healing and reconciliation be established to ensure that war crimes and human rights abuses are investigated and perpetrators are held to account. At today's news conference announcing their petition, Lopedia said the transitional government of national unity can pave the way for real change in South Sudan.
We believe that a woman can bring the change that we haven't seen for a long time in this transitional period. The transitional constitution has to be reviewed. We have issues with the age of marriage. We have issues with families. These are issues that we want during the review of the process. With the presence of a woman legislature, we will be able to see some of these changes for the families, first of all.
Lopedia says the 18 women groups represented at today's press conference have yet to select a candidate to fill the post of parliamentary speaker, but says they will do so in the near future. And she called on President Kiir and other officials to seriously consider their candidate for the speaker. For VOA News, I am Philip Tona Leo in Juba.
A new report released by a local diocese of the Roman Catholic Church on recent fighting in Yambio between government forces and local vigilantes says more than 150 houses were burned down, hundreds of others were looted, and more than 8 young girls were raped. As we hear from Gift Friday in Yambio, the report does not state which side committed the abuses.
The report produced by the Justice and Peace Commission of the Catholic Diocese of Tombra, Yambio, says local residents report seeing men in uniforms, but both government forces and local vigilantes called Aero Boys have been known to wear uniforms. The report indicates that most of the destruction was carried out on December 8th and 9th during stepped-up fighting between government forces and local armed groups known as the Aero Boys. According to the report, residential areas of Ikpiro, Haitarawa, Haikabash were the most affected when the conflict first escalated last month. Alson Gizam is the commission's acting manager.
About 155 tukuls were burnt from Kabash up to Ipiro, because all this were they are considered one area. About 341 house and shops were looted. And some were looted, and there are some few cases of rapes.
Gizam says the Catholic Church report was based on field assessments and interviews with IDPs in the affected areas. It calls on the government to provide food as well as psychological counseling and social services to IDPs affected by the fighting.
We make some recommendation to the humanitarian response to make quick intervention with non-food items and food items to help to rescue these situations, because the IDPs are really in desperate, in need of food, non-food items. There is a need for trauma healing and counseling.
The report calls on church leaders to mediate between government forces and local vigilantes to resolve the conflict. Yambio Municipality Mayor Daniel Badagbu confirms that abuses were committed against civilians.
Actually, what was happening is that these bandits used to come to break into houses and ask for money. Basically, 3 major residential areas, that is in Mapere, Korobodi, 1 and 2, and these are the areas that were deserted.
Mayor Badagbu says for the last 10 days, Yambio has been calm. He says life is slowly returning to normal. Badagbu says the government will help these affected by the fighting, but says they are waiting for the official report from the Justice and Peace Commission so they can take action.
Government, we are doing all what we can to make sure we support them sooner than later. We are trying our best to make sure we offer them psychosocial support, counseling, medical checkup, and they are being returned back to their normal days.
Badagbu says authorities will arrest all those accused of killing, looting or raping. So far, Badagbu says the government has facilitated the return of 50 heads of families who had sought refuge near the Democratic Republic of Congo border. He says several others have returned to their homes voluntarily. According to the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, more than 6,000 people fled into neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo and Uganda from the Maridi, Amadi states since violence broke out between government forces and local vigilantes last year. For VOA, I'm Gift Friday in Juba.
The price of crude oil has dropped to its lowest level in 18 months, which is not good news for South Sudan. A barrel of crude has dropped by more than $62 on the world market since 2014. According to the New York Mercantile Exchange, the last high price for crude oil was in June 2014 when it sold for $93.14 a barrel. Since then, the price for crude has been steadily falling. On Tuesday, the price reached just $31 a barrel. In South Sudan, where the economy largely depends on oil revenues, the government has been struggling to pay its bills, especially after the conflict, which broke out in late 2013. That further reduced oil production in the country as well. South Sudan depends on oil exports to fund at least 80% of its annual budget. The Brent crude, used as an international benchmark, fell as low as $29.96 for a while yesterday, but bounced back to trade at $32.22 a barrel. Analysts expect the prices to drop even further in coming days.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Liberia is declared Ebola-free. More on that when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how often do you keep in touch with your extended family?
Not often. No particular reason.
Daily. I call my mom daily, my brothers, my uncles, all of them, daily, at least daily.
Maybe once a year or so, because I'm busy throughout the year.
I get across my extended families. I call them maybe every two, three days, at least once in a week.
As I speak with you now, I have members of my extended family living with me in my house, and so it's a very frequent interaction with extended family.
Extended, now it depends on how far they are from me. Like my immediate first cousins, we are very close and I keep in touch with them regularly.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. The World Health Organization says the most recent outbreak of Ebola in Liberia is over, bringing the number of cases in West Africa down to zero for the first time since the regional epidemic began in early 2014. The WHO reports all known chains of transmission have been stopped in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, the three most heavily affected countries. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The World Health Organization reports more than 11,300 people have died and more than 28,500 infected since Ebola was first recognized in Guinea in March 2014. WHO Director of Emergency Risk Management and Humanitarian Response, Rick Brennan, says it has taken an enormous collective effort by the affected countries and international community to free West Africa of this disease.
While this is an important milestone and a very important step forward, we have to say that the job is still not done. That's because there is still ongoing risk of re-emergence of the disease because of persistence of the virus in a proportion of survivors.
The World Health Organization reports the Ebola virus can persist in the semen of survivors for up to 1 year, and they can transmit the disease to their partners. There have been 10 flare-ups of Ebola in the West African countries after they were declared free of the virus. The disease has re-emerged three times in Liberia since it was first declared Ebola-free in May 2015. Dr. Brennan warns the WHO anticipates more flare-ups, but says there is little danger of these turning into a full-blown epidemic.
Firstly, the risk is relatively low, but it is significant. As I said, we've had 10 of these flare-ups. Secondly, the risk is going to reduce over time as the immune systems of the survivors clear the virus from the body of those survivors. And thirdly, that the countries of West Africa have put in mechanisms to manage that risk.
Brennan says the WHO and its partners are also providing medical and psychosocial care to survivors. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Regional political leaders in Cameroon are urging citizens to be vigilant following an attack yesterday on a mosque in northern in the In a northern part of the country that killed at least 12 people, the suicide bombing was the latest in a series of attacks on mosques blamed on Boko Haram militants. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Mijiyawa Bakari, governor of the far north region of Cameroon, says Muslims should be on guard at mosques to help avert the kind of attacks that have plagued Muslims attending morning prayers. Bakari says he is asking the population to create vigilante groups to control access to mosques and places where people gather. He says all prayer sessions in mosques should be divided into two, with the first group praying and the second group keeping watch. The groups would then switch. He says unknown people should not be given access to mosques. Bakari says the attack in the town of Kolofata is believed to have been carried out by Boko Haram members who crossed the border into Cameroon a few days ago. He says it was the third attack on a mosque in less than 3 weeks. The town of Kolofata in Cameroon's far north, near the border, has been repeatedly attacked by Boko Haram, a Nigerian Islamic extremist group. Muslim cleric Imam Amidu Mustafa of Kolofata says asking a Muslim not to pray with others of their faith is contrary to their religious teachings, but he says it is an option when they are faced with terrorist acts.
Remettez le Coran à n'importe qui, vous lui demandez de lire pour mieux comprendre l'islam.
Mustafa says the most important thing is for people to forgo rivalries and to work together for peace. He says people should understand there will always be differences among them. General Koji Jacob, a senior commander of troops fighting the Boko Haram insurgency, has also called on the population to collaborate with the government by reporting suspicious strangers and denouncing suspects. He says the border between Cameroon and Nigeria is very porous and the military alone cannot secure it.
À partir d'ici, vous voyez les Nigériens qui passent autour. C'est les mêmes familles.
Jacob says there is regular movement of people across the Cameroon-Nigeria border, and it is the role of the military to systematically check people crossing it. For the past 6 years, Boko Haram has been leading attacks on Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, and Niger in an effort to set up an Islamic caliphate. Since last November, Nigerian and Cameroonian forces have increased raids on Boko Haram strongholds to crush the insurgency. Officials say the raids have weakened Boko Haram's capacity to fight back, forcing them to attack the mosques. The group also has increasingly targeted imams and traditional chiefs for their opposition to the Islamists. Cameroon has banned the Islamic veil in an effort to preempt suicide bombings staged by attackers wearing the full face veil. According to the United Nations, about 20,000 people have been killed and left more than 2 million made homeless in Boko Haram-related violence. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
And from Cameroon, we move to Nigeria, where 9 months ago, the new president there promised to end Boko Haram's six-year reign of terror in those three northwestern states. He also vowed to end corruption in his federal government. There's but the problem of lifting millions of people out of poverty as well. The $31 billion budget Muhammadu Buhari delivered to Parliament last month includes spending increases of some 20%. With the steep drop in oil prices, it is unclear where that money will come from. David Arnold reports for VOA from Washington.
For years, Nigeria's economy and its government have depended on selling crude oil to the world. But government revenues are falling right along with oil prices. Now, President Buhari faces a financial challenge in keeping his promises to voters. Nigeria has asked for a meeting of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, to discuss falling prices. The meeting could be scheduled for March. Amadou Si is the director of the Brookings Institution's Africa Growth Initiative. The Economist looked at Mr. Buhari's 2016 budget to see if he has the financial resources to succeed.
Well, I hope he will be successful because, as you said, Nigeria is one of the engine of growth in Africa. It's the largest economy. It's the most populous economy. It's the champion in the ECOWAS in West Africa. But so far, all the signals he's giving to me are the right signals, but he has to keep on staying the course and also showing some flexibility when it needs to adjust.
With the drop in oil prices, C says Mr. Buhari is counting on other sources of revenue.
I think that he charts a very clear roadmap for the country, and my guess is that the main issue will be the implementation. But when it comes to the roadmap, I think he acknowledges the issues. For example, in the budget, the benchmark price of oil has been reduced from $53 per barrel to about $38 per barrel, and they've recognized that they will have less fiscal revenues. You know, two-thirds of Nigeria's government revenues typically come from oil. So what he's trying to do is have a two-pronged approach, judging from the budget. So in the short term, they will try to spend more on infrastructure. So the idea here is to spend money on power, roads, and so on. And then hopefully that will help unleash some growth in sectors like agriculture and mining, for example. By reviving the economy, the hope is to grow the non-oil economy and then tax this non-oil economy more. And then what he'll try to do is to basically widen the base for tax collection and have less corruption in the collection of revenues. As you've seen also, he has basically changed the leadership of the major revenue-generating agencies, especially the National Petroleum Corporation.
Amadou C. recognizes that Mr. Buhari is not new to the job. He served as Nigeria's president once before. But there are a couple of areas where he thinks the president must be careful.
It's the biggest economy in the region, but there is some risk. So one is the foreign exchange policy. Will you really adopt there? And the second one is, will you be able to get the financing that you need when you need it at the interest rate you want? So there are some risks. But overall, I would give him good grades on this budget. Now the implementation will be key. That will be really key. But he's been there before.
After so many years of government mismanagement of the Nigerian economy, it may be too late to recapture so many lost opportunities. But C believes Mr. Buhari has good intentions.
The country has less freedom of opportunity to really make a big dent on poverty, a big dent on human development. It was easier before. It's harder now. So he's trying. If he fails, then we will lose a lot of time and effort, and it will have human development impact on this country.
C adds that should Buhari fail to turn Nigeria's economy around, there could be negative consequences for Nigeria's neighbors as well. This is David Arnold at VOA News in Washington, D.C.
Zimbabwe's Constitutional Court began its year yesterday with a request from 15 death row prisoners for their sentences to be commuted. From Harare, Sebastian Mofu reports for VOA that rights lawyers are hoping the death penalty will be outlawed in Zimbabwe this year.
The lawyer for the 15 said they have been waiting for their execution for periods ranging between 4 and 20 years. All have been convicted of murder or treason, which carry capital sentences in Zimbabwe. Their lawyer, former Zimbabwe Finance Minister Tendai Biti, says after this case is over, he wants the death penalty completely outlawed.
When someone has been sentenced to death, he can't be subjected to death row and wait for so many years on death row. And we're saying that is unconstitutional. We would like to challenge the death penalty, and I believe we will do so this year once Parliament has passed the amendments to the Criminal Procedure and Evidence Act. We don't believe in the death penalty. And you can also see that some of the judges also don't believe in it, including the Minister of Justice, now a Vice President, who feel very strongly against the death penalty. They just said they had the courage of simply saying, let's outlaw it.
The Vice President Biti refers to is Emmerson Mnangagwa, who opposes death penalty. In 2013, Mnangagwa said he would rather resign than sign certificates for executions.
We have 89 people on the death row. Two of them are women. And they are lucky. They are not signing papers for their execution. At the end of the day, I think commitment to life imprisonment.
Since those comments, the number of prisoners awaiting execution has risen to more than 100. Beatty says a ban on the death penalty must come from the courts instead of depending on the benevolence of one politician. On Wednesday, he argued that Zimbabwe's constitution protects everyone, including convicted prisoners, against torture or cruel, inhuman, and degrading punishment. He said the long periods his clients have waited in prison, never knowing when they might be hanged, amount to such punishment. Death row prisoners in Zimbabwe are not told in advance of the date and time of their execution. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Here is a recap of today's top stories. A consortium of South Sudanese women's groups is urging the parties to the peace agreement to appoint a female speaker for the National Legislative Assembly and to appoint women to other high-ranking positions to help balance the power in a society they say is dominated by men. They sent a petition to President Salva Kiir and copied opposition groups detailing their requests. Ida Lopidia, director of EVE Organization for Women Development, praised both parties for distributing the portfolios of ministers earlier this week. Now she says it's time to address which women will be appointed to top government positions during the 30 months of transitional government of national unity. Lopidia says, "We have seen the executives and all the positions are filled by men. We have seen the president, the first vice president, and the vice president are all men. So we are strongly calling that the position of the Speaker of Parliament be filled by a woman." Chapter 1, Article 4, Subsection 11 of the peace agreement states that the government shall fill the position of speaker with someone who hails from the Equatoria area. Lopidia says South Sudan's transitional constitution of 2011 and the August 2015 peace deal both require that 25% of all government positions be occupied by women, a point that Lopidia says should not be up for discussion. She says a woman speaker of parliament will ensure that legislation is passed to protect the right of girls to remain in school, and to monitor abuses against women in the home. A new report released by local diocese in Yambio of the Roman Catholic Church on recent fighting there between government forces and local vigilantes says more than 150 houses were burned down and more than 300 properties were looted. It also says at least 8 young girls were raped. The report does not state which side committed the abuses. Eyewitnesses told church representatives who interviewed local residents that they saw men in uniforms looting property and burning houses. Both government forces and local vigilantes, called Arrow Boys, are known to wear uniforms. The church is asking the government to provide social services and psychological counseling for locals traumatized by the recent violence. And finally, the price of crude oil has dropped to its lowest level in 18 months. A barrel of crude has now dropped by more than $62 on the world market since 2014. That's a look at some of today's top stories. And that's our show for this Thursday. We leave you with the song Uru Kudu by Kidum.
Nimbari kuno kuno mona na bonyuru kundari mainda du na bonyaru kundo na kunzu morondo na wembandi sese sinamubu inga nubu menyini tangi sikanwa temera kubiki matitu kundo temeru rufu kwa banu Femera, si lo fuiste el amor con lo fugani
We've been listening to Kadum with the song Urukundo. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.